But rather than a cynical politics of fear driven by politicians from above, as some people will have it in the academic literature, I see it very much more as a demand for protection coming from below, from a very atomized and, you know, public who have an exaggerated sense of vulnerability. So at the very least, it works two ways. And it's within that context, and I've sort of labored the context, it's within that context that 9/11 happened. Within that context of that long series of exaggerated risks and scares that I've already described to you, that then we saw the events in New York and in Washington. Now, the good side of that story, if there is one, would be to remind people that the actual cost of 9/11, both in reparation, compensation, and everything else, was actually less than 1% of US gross domestic product in any one year, which rather shows that our societies are fairly resilient to even quite severe shocks. Enron and WorldCom, as some of you may know, cost a darn sight more. But what we find is that this kind of sense of vulnerability that people have encourages politicians to shift from a kind of evidence-based what-is policymaking towards a much more speculative what-if, particularly after 9/11, where politicians were encouraged to think the unthinkable, and indeed in America, hired Hollywood film producers and directors to come and advise them as to possible scenarios in the future, because the spooks didn't feel that they would be creative enough themselves, and so they wanted that real sort of cutting-edge creative input. What you see is a shift in society from a kind of probabilistic basis for decision-making. In other words, you know, what's the fact, what's the data, how likely is it, towards a possibilistic basis for decision-making. You know, anything that's possible now has to be mitigated against, with quite dramatic consequences. Because, of course, like Istanbul, there's no limit to what the unthinkable is that you might come up with. Indeed, when people started in America speculating about the possibility that Saddam Hussein may have bizarrely acquired smallpox, then there was no limit to the consequences. I mean, despite the fact that we know that there are only two secure facilities on Earth that still hold smallpox, one in the US and one in the former Soviet Union, the fact that we know that neither of them had suffered a security breach did not stop people from speculating about the worst case, what if? And once you do that, then there's no limit. So then we needed to stockpile vaccines for smallpox, despite the fact that it had been eradicated 30 years previously. And of course, then the emergency responders said, well, hang on, it's not good enough just having the vaccine. You know, it'll be too late if there's an outbreak to vaccinate us. We need to vaccinate the rest of the population. So you needed to start applying the vaccine to people working in hospitals and other related services. And of course, once the public saw that in America, they started saying, well, hang on, if it's good enough for them, I want it too. And a discourse that had started in America migrated across the Atlantic and then across the Channel and then affected everybody, much faster than the disease itself, I might add. But you can see that one of the consequences is that we distract our attention from far more plausible sources of risk, like influenza maybe, and also divert our resources in a way that might not be sensible if one were to apply a judicious sense of proportion to some of the debates that we're talking about. Fear of chemical, biological, radiological weapons can be, in many instances, an even bigger problem than the problem that people believe that they're trying to deal with. After the anthrax incidents in Washington, there were quite a few cases in America of what's known in the literature as mass psychogenic illness. That's people literally worrying themselves sick. There was a case on the Maryland subway where 35 people had to be hospitalized because they started by saying, can you smell something strange? And then they started talking to one, yeah, I can smell that. And then, you know, oh, I've got really itchy eyes. You've got itchy eyes too. But hospitalized, so it goes beyond nausea, vomiting, headaches, all of the other things that they talk themselves into. And it turns out to be window cleaning fluid. And there are many other instances that I could point to in the literature in a similar vein. Now, in reality, by the way, there's a positive side to this story. How we as a society respond to emergencies has been quite well mapped out in the literature, particularly a couple of individuals from the University of Delaware in America, Ed Quarantelli and Russell Dines, did quite a lot of the work on this, dating right back to the 50s. And they point out that how we deal with emergencies has got a lot more to do with our outlook as a society than the nature of the emergency itself. You know, that societies that are confident, clear as to what their purpose is, know what they're about, are much more capable of picking themselves up after a shock than those where that may not apply. The agent matters at the margin, in other words, what creates the emergency, but it's a secondary effect. And there are many, many examples that I could give you of this. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, for instance, why it is that certain emergencies feature prominently in the public imagination, why a large number of you in this room, for instance, will know pretty much where you were when you heard that the Challenger space shuttle had blown up in 1987, with the loss of 7 lives. And at the same time, there's hardly any contemporary popular memory of the fact that in the 1950s, thousands of people died in the London smog, or that, you know, best part of 100 people die on the roads of Britain every week. Doesn't feature so prominently. And the point that Carantelli and Dines allude to is the fact that actually what we as a society define to be an emergency depends on the meaning that we apply to that particular threat. Challenger, as it happens, fed into a debate about the ability of science to boldly reach out and that humanity had no limits, and it fed into a debate that humanity had maybe overreached itself and then accelerated that debate. Hatfield, more recently, with the loss of 4 lives, fed into a cynicism about government privatisation of the railways. So, in fact, it was the real incident is twisted to some alternative political debate that's going on at the time. And it's that meaning that determines how society deals with things. I wrote quite a few years ago that actually terrorism is really interesting because it teaches us far more about ourselves as a society than it teaches us about the terrorists. I know that lots of people in the security world have got very excited into trying to understand the psychology of the terrorists, the culture of the Middle East. They've all gone off to read the Quran and try and decrypt whether there's something hidden in the verses there telling them what to do. All the time, I have been suggesting that maybe we ought to focus a little bit more on how we're responding to it, and we might learn a little bit more that way. See, the odd thing about emergencies and disasters, including terrorist attacks, is that in a society where social bonds have been fragmented, society I kind of described earlier, oddly enough, and in a perverse way, they act as one of the rare opportunities to rebuild some of those social bonds. A disaster or an emergency destroys physical capital, destroys economic capital, but it acts as a rare opportunity in the modern world to build up social capital, for want of a better phrase. There are many examples in the literature of communities who felt themselves to be better off as a consequence of having been through a crisis than adjacent communities that hadn't. The examples I point to here are particularly in relation to tornadoes in America, where you'll know they have very defined paths that they go through. So they readily destroy a town on one side of a freeway, but not the town on the other side. And what social researchers found subsequently is that the town that had been hit had a much stronger sense of community about it because everybody had to muck in and sort things out than the town that hadn't been hit. So, but of course, we live in an age where there's a presumption, quite often promoted by a whole army of psychotherapeutic counsellors, that actually people can't cope and that if you're hit by something, then you'll never recover and you're going to need lifelong professional support, which, by the way, there's a whole literature suggesting that that may not be true. Emergency responders actually have to learn how to support ordinary people getting together and dealing with their problems rather than supplant them. There is a tendency, unfortunately, once the professionals arrive, to put up yellow perimeter tape or blue and white perimeter tape and then tell people to go away, go home, we're here now, we're going to sort it out, which in many instances may be quite counterproductive because ordinary people on the ground who were the true first responders have actually started sorting a few things out themselves and rebuilding those communal bonds that are quite important. It's actually quite a while after the emergency, because emergencies actually bring out the best in people. They're one of the rare moments where people stop staring into their own navels and thinking about me, 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 and how vulnerable I am, and start actually seeing, oh, maybe the person at the end of the corridor, who I always thought was a bit weird, may be useful, and maybe together we can do something, and, you know, you start helping one another. People are at their most focused, most cooperative, and most social in emergencies, with very, very few exceptions. And, you know, at the same time, however, there's a kind of promotion of a discourse of panic and chaos. It's much later that then people begin to reabsorb the dominant values of their culture. You know, once the immediacy of needing to sort out the problem has subsided, then of course all of the dominant claptrap of contemporary culture that you can't trust anyone, that you are extremely vulnerable, all of that comes flooding back in. So the heroes of the hour in New York, the fire department, then 3 months later start putting their claims in for having worked excessive hours, for having inhaled fumes that they shouldn't have inhaled, that are bound to be toxic, that are bound to have scarred them for life, as they reabsorb that kind of dominant presumption that we're vulnerable and we can't cope. I could go through many examples of this, some more funny than others. I'll just give you a quick one. But I mean, just on the presumption that therapeutic counselling is always the solution to things. I mean, by the way, that, you know, nature did a great thing with human beings, which is it made us forget things in certain instances. And forgetting is actually quite helpful and healthy. Of course, the first thing a counsellor wants you to do is to remember everything and to bring it out. There's this kind of presumption that purging yourself by talking about things over and over again is going to help. It may help a few individuals. I'm not denying a need for professional therapeutic counsellors for a few individuals who really can't cope. But once we start promoting it as the solution to everybody's problems, then oddly enough, the few people who really need it can't get access to it because everybody's having their counselling session in the meantime. But part of the reconstruction effort in the war in Kosovo, not from the British military, I might add, was to send an army of therapeutic counsellors to talk to people about their experiences there. And what they found, what these counsellors found, and this is on the basis of the work of Vanessa Pupovac at the University of Nottingham, what the counsellors found was fairly ordinary people who wanted someone to help them rebuild their house and someone to help them relocate their relatives, but not someone with a clipboard saying, what do you dream about at night? And how often do you dream about it? And they thought this was very bizarre. And actually, more of the counsellors, when they came back to the UK, claimed that they'd been traumatised by their experience in Kosovo as a percentage than the people they'd gone out to help. Now, just a few kind of wrapping up words about what resilience is and then what the real nature of the threat that we face today is, because I think there's a few myths about that. Sadly, I've been to many events since 9/11, and mostly all the talk about resilience is focused on the need for technology. And huge amounts of money have been poured into technical means for making societies more resilient. And they include concrete box, fences, vaccines, CCTV, more intelligence, more detection equipment for chemical, biological, radiological agents, more protective clothing so that the emergency responders can wear space suits every time a bit of cocaine is found in a toilet at the BBC and scare the hell out of everyone, and more computer models to predict your behaviour and whether you're a terrorist based on what you bought in Tesco's last week. So there's a kind of whole raft of money being spent on kind of technical means for dealing with terrorism. Very little on the kind of social aspects that I've discussed with you this afternoon. And I think that comes from a misconception, even in the Anglo-Saxon world, of what the word resilience really means. I know that when I talk to particularly people across the channel about this, they have great difficulty with the word resilience because they don't have an equivalent in their language. But we ought to know what it means. And I think it means more than just preparing for an emergency, responding to an emergency, and recovering from it. I actually think resilience ought to mean orienting society well before any emergency. In other words, having a clear sense of where it is that we're going as a society. And if you think about it, if the resilience in shorthand is the ability to pick yourself up after a shock and keep on going with what you wanted to achieve in the first place, then you need, before the shock, to know what it was you were seeking to achieve. But actually, today, we live in an age where people are not that clear as to who they are, what they stand for, and where they're going. And until we have that debate as a society, no matter how much we spend on technical means for dealing with terrorism or any other emergency, we're not necessarily going to be in a good position to deal with it. I always point out to people that I suspect that some of the people I teach go off to fight wars, or others may fight fires or fight crime, not because they want their children to grow up to fight wars, fight fire or fight crime, but because they think that there's something more important to life worth fighting for. But as a society, where's that debate about what the something more important to life is? Whatever it is that your beliefs are. Where's that kind of political debate as to who we are as a society, what we stand for and where we're going? How much has that been clarified since 9/11? Now, a few quick words about the incidents in London 2 summers ago. Some people are under a misconception as to what I said before then, and they believe that I said, oh, terrorism, schmerism, it's never going to happen. I'm actually on the record on Adam Curtis's series, Power of Nightmares, as saying no one is saying that these incidents will not happen. What we're suggesting is that our fear of them and our responses when they happen may be, in some instances, more damaging than the instances themselves. After the attacks in London on the 7th of July 2005, or just over a year, just under a year actually afterwards, the government put out the report of the official account of the bombings in London on the 7th of July. There's something really interesting about that report, if some of you may have read it. Right at the beginning, it describes itself as a narrative. That's actually quite telling, because actually it's a very good description of what it is. But you know, a narrative basically tells you what happened, when it happened, where it happened, who did it, how they did it. But despite the best part of a year looking into it, and despite a whole chapter devoted to it, it does not begin to address why they did it. And you know, if you don't know why they did it, or you don't have an appreciation as to why they did it, then you're in a very difficult position in order to preclude that kind of incident from happening again. And more problematically, particularly in academic circles, if you're not clear as to why they did it, or you project to why they did it, then indeed it allows all manner of pundit, commentator, academic with their own pet prejudices and theories to project their own version as to why they did it into the vacuum of information. And so we see, you know, everybody speculating wildly from, well, obviously it's got to do with being brought up, you know, going to school in a madrasa and listening to the radical and inflammatory rhetoric of a crazed mullah, and or it's got to do with Israel, it's got to do with Iraq, and you know, every theory under the sun, social exclusion, racism, has all been thrown into the pot. But of course, the reality is that the terrorists themselves are not that good at identifying why they're doing what they're doing. Even if you watch Mohammed Sadiq Khan's so-called martyrdom video, you ought to note, for instance, that he doesn't mention Iraq once, although he does mention, you know, a general disgruntlement with what, you know, our forces are doing to my people, although quite who elected him to be a representative of my people is far from clear. In fact, the report of the official account makes it rather clear that most of those theories are not at all true. And what we're actually seeing is academics, or indeed other security consultants and analysts, starting with their presumed conclusion as to why they did it, and then looking for evidence that that conclusion is borne out by tracing backwards. But anyone who's studied science, and even social science, ought to know that starting with the answer and then going back to look for the evidence is not a particularly scientific way of operating. It allows you to project whatever it is that you want to project into the situation. The report makes it fairly clear that these individuals were, quote, unexceptional, that the means they used were, you know, readily available, and that anyone with a modicum of, you know, some kind of basic education could have achieved what they achieved. Two of them did travel to Pakistan. I've heard it suggested that maybe they met somebody out there who was a specialist in bomb making who helped them do what they did. But actually, if you look at the work of Mark Sageman, the American academic at Princeton University, who's probably done the most comprehensive analysis of Al-Qaeda types, what Mark will point out is that really the only factors that you can see that are what you might call radicalizing factors in people's backgrounds are a middle-class background, a degree of higher education, which obviously puts us all at risk of becoming terrorists, but more importantly, what he identifies is that these individuals go to look for a group after they've decided to act. And indeed, that may well have applied in relation to the 7th of July last year. In other words, what you find is people who have got a sense of alienation, disconnection, disgruntlement from society. They've got no evident connection to Afghanistan, Iraq, Chechnya, Palestine, or anywhere else that you care to mention outside of Leeds, but who basically identify with some kind of struggle that doesn't really belong to them, but they feel that they've got some form of connection to it, and then go out seeking expertise and organizations to join. In other words, Islam, in many instances, is more like a motif rather than a motive. You know, it's the kind of badge of honor for anyone who wants to stick two fingers up to the West and scare the hell out of us, which they do relatively effectively, rather than necessarily the driving force that radicalizes them, as many presume it to be. I just want to conclude with a few, just a couple of comments about how dangerous it might be to presume otherwise, as indeed many people do, and to try and suggest maybe where they do get their ideas from. There is, some of you may know, I'm not sure if it's finished because I haven't followed the whole thing, but there was the trial of the what's known as the Crawley Group, a group of individuals who bought a little bit too much ammonium nitrate fertilizer than they needed for their gardens. It's interesting, in the kind of trial, what emerges is their list of intended targets, which included all the usual picture postcard targets and, you know, government buildings and all of that. But also, interestingly, shoppers in Dartford, binge drinkers, football hooligans, and, quote, slags in nightclubs. Now, I don't know how many of you have read the Quran, but you ought to know that binge drinkers, shoppers in Dartford, football hooligans, and slags in nightclubs don't feature prominently in that text. And so you kind of begin to think, well, I wonder where they got this agenda from, that society's degenerate, corrupt, full of binge drinkers, football hooligans, slags. And you actually begin to look at the political scene around you, or maybe open the pages of the Daily Mail on an average Wednesday, and realise that actually these ideas are all around us. You know, these ideas are very much the contemporary cultural outlook of our times. Yeah, make a slight exaggeration to make a point. But, you know, the assumption that we're corrupt, selfish, degenerate, and decadent is quite a dominant assumption that does the round in academic milieus and way beyond. Indeed, I suggest to you that New Labour has targeted all of those groups. You know, excessive consumption, binge drinking, football hooligans. Obviously, they wouldn't be so gauche as to say slags in nightclubs. They'd dress it up as an anti-chlamydia campaign. But it kind of makes the same point. And then I kind of like reminding people that maybe when Michael Moore's Stupid White Men became the best-selling book on both sides of the Atlantic, a few people in the security world would have woken up to the fact that it wasn't just being read by Muslims, but the fact that it sold 300,000 copies in its first year of publication in the UK alone rather suggests that there was a popular resonance for this kind of cultural self-loathing, this kind of denigration of everything that we've achieved, what we stand for, you know, the whole of the past is tarnished. And I could go on. You know, when Professor Sir Martin Rees, the president of the Royal Society, writes a cheerfully numbered book, Our Final Century, you know that the doom-mongers really are everywhere around us. When the New Scientist runs a front cover and article that goes with it last October that speculates positively about what the planet would have been like if only humanity had never existed, and presumably not the New Scientist either, if they follow their own logic, you kind of see that there's this kind of deeply embedded negative outlook to human beings that is our own outlook. You know, John Gray, the professor of European thought at the London School of Economics, in his book Straw Dogs, suggests that humanity is a plague upon the planet. And so, just in conclusion, I would like to suggest to you that maybe, you know, the terrorists who perpetrated their acts in London 2 summers ago are not quite as foreign as some people like to imagine. Maybe they're not influenced by some bizarre foreign ideology, but rather they're embedded, brought up, educated within our culture, which has got quite a strong, negative, dystopian, pessimistic outlook, which they then feel, maybe with an added sense of victimhood, propelled to act upon. But if you think they're all going to be from Asian backgrounds, you know, think again. After the arrests last summer, the 10th of August, the plot to blow up the aircraft using liquid explosives, some people expressed surprise that one of the people arrested was the son of a Conservative Party agent. I suspect we'll find many more individuals in this category. Not huge numbers. And I think, you know, just going back to the beginning, not to get a distorted sense of proportion about the scale of the threat that we face, but maybe it's time we started having a bit of a more honest debate about who it is that we are as a society, what we stand for, what we want to celebrate, rather than getting fixated about what they're thinking, who they are, what they're up to. If we were a bit clearer as to what it is that we stand for, maybe we'd find less of them to have to deal with.
Now, from slightly in the box, we move, well, out of the proverbial box. This is Sibel Edmonds and James Corbett, continuing where they left off last time.
Let's talk a little bit more about Bibeson's activities in particular and NATO's role in that, and start to talk about how there is protection for some of these high agents and drug runners, not only in Bibeson's case, but in others that we're going to highlight in this conversation as well.
Sure. Again, with Hussein Bibeson, and this was in 2003, 2004, when his attorney in Holland, in the Netherlands, contacted me. Until that point, I was not familiar with Biberson, okay? Because his operation was mainly based in Europe, specifically United Kingdom, Brussels, Balkans, Turkey, Afghanistan. And I didn't know his name. In fact, when I was contacted by his attorney, I was like, well, I don't know who he is. And that was when his attorney sent me links to some of his interviews. I believe I received a copy of his book. No publisher was willing to publish it. In fact, you won't find it in the market. His previous attorney published this book in UK. He wrote it in Turkish. It was translated by one of his advocates in England, but it was self-published and maybe a few hundred copies were sold, and you won't find it in the market. But they sent me a copy of his book. They also gave me the links, and when I read the sections in the interviews that he provided to both reporters in Guardian, in his book, and also drug links, I saw all these references of how he was working for the state, and that is Turkey, and how this drug operation, multi-billions dollars, drug operations were under him, but he was under the Turkish state, Turkish military, and the distribution of transportation of this multi-billion dollar heroin was conducted through the Turkish diplomatic communities and Turkish military communities overseas. And by Turkish military communities overseas, he meant, you know, the Turkish NATO, the Turkish arm of NATO. And it's very easy. And as soon as I read these interviews, I knew that his case was connected to my case. His involved, you know, UK aspect of it, Europe, mine involved the United States. And I knew, because I knew the Hussein Biberson's of the United States, okay? The Pablo Escobar's of the United States dealing with heroin, you know? This is, there's a cocaine godfathers and there are heroin godfathers. And especially those who were most active in from mid-1990s till, you know, 9/11, a few months after 9/11. And we briefly mentioned and talked about Abdullah Çatlı when we started our interview series. Well, that was, again, one of his major roles that he played. And again, it was from his base in Chicago. And another person I'm going to talk about, and the reason I'm able to talk about it is because this information became public at a time. Even though now the links to news sources, you see the references to articles, to even court documents or DEA documents, drug enforcement agencies, and some of these investigations of this drug case that I'm going to talk about was it was a joint work between the FBI and the drug enforcement agencies, would be one of the guys who worked with and for under Abdullah Çatlı. And his name was Yaşar Öz OZ. Again, the links to the Turkish articles are not broken. You can still see mainstream Turkish reports during these years on Yaşar Öz. Well, Yaşar Öz was a major operative for Gladio Plan A from original ones in Europe, but also for the U.S. arms of it under Abdullah Çatlı. And in 1996, around early 1997, during that time frame, Yaşar Öz, during one of his many trips to the United States, because they managed multi-billion dollars worth heroin, and this is heroin sourced from Afghanistan, this is before 9/11, this is when a lot of mainstream publications refer to, oh, once Taliban took over Afghanistan, they stopped the opium production, even though the opium production was peaking, going, expanding all the way till the end of 2000. And we'll come back to this. Anyhow, so this guy, this heroin that was entering U.S. from Europe, a lot of it from Brussels, through this guy and Abdullah Çatlı was for the U.S. part, it was sourced to, you know, Afghanistan. These are Afghan-based heroin produced that from that opium. So during his last trip in the United States, Yaşar Öz was arrested, busted by a joint FBI and DEA operation in New Jersey. He actually was meeting with a foreign correspondent, this Turkish reporter who was based in New York, you know, corresponding, you know, and reporting back to Turkey to one of their mainstream media sources, which we will one day talk about it. And there are the various ways of intelligence collection. A lot of people talk about and know about, oh, yeah, the CIAs who have State Department assignments, they are assigned to some embassies and consulates. That's the really old way. And the real spies are not placed in embassies because everybody knows where to look at embassies. Each country, especially the important countries, act differently in terms of where they like to place their intelligence gatherers. Anyhow, so he was meeting with this reporter who was also involved in the network, and the bust took place. And he had with him several kilograms of pure heroin. They arrested him. In fact, it even leaked to the media, U.S. media, that this Turkish guy, because this was a high amount, kilogram of heroin, and Turkish guy was arrested. Then they took him to DEA's New Jersey office for interrogation. And this interesting, very, very interesting thing happens, and this gets to be reported a couple of days later. While he was being interrogated by DEA agents in one of DEA's field offices in New Jersey, he found a way to escape. He then went to JFK that same day, and he boarded the first class Turkish airline at 10:30 p.m. that evening and went to Turkey. So something took place between the time he was arrested in New Jersey and a few hours later. The public, you know, they don't know. Actually, nobody knows in the U.S. because there was a little blurb news in the media here. But then there was no follow-up reports from the media here in the U.S. Like, well, how did he escape? He was arrested. He was in this field office for interrogation. And then he just sneaked out, didn't go in hiding somewhere. He went to JFK. And from there, he boarded first class Turkish Airlines and went to Turkey. Well, what happened is we in the FBI knew, because there are files on this, because it's again related to the same Gladio B operation. As soon as he was arrested, within just a few minutes, the news went to the State Department. Again, you have to ask, who's informing the State Department? Yeah, he's a foreign national thug, and actually he was one of the wanted as well within Europol, Interpol during this time. But State Department steps in, and within a couple of hours, DEA told, release this guy, FBI told, release this guy. Why? Because he has diplomatic immunity. Now, he doesn't have any title that says he's in any way connected, official title, to Turkish embassies or consulates or Turkish military attaché. However, he carries this passport because he had four passports. He also had special NATO ID with him. So Yashar Öz was released quietly. And when the media, both from Turkey and here, they saw some comments, DA said, oh, he escaped. We don't know. He just evaporated during this.
Tell me how that works. But so just to be clear, how was Yashar Öz related to Abdullah Çatlı? Were they partners?
These are the operatives. You know, they're no different than, you know, let's say CIA operatives. These are the black ops operatives for the NATO Gladio A, because these are the guys who basically handled both on the ground, but within their own mafia network, which was Abdullah Çatlı, who was he and why he was recruited. Well, first he was in jail, then he was released so that he would be trained and join NATO and Turkey's Gladio operation in 1980s. Same thing with some of these other guys. Well, the same thing with Yashar Öz. He was, again, one of the godfathers, but his ranking would be below Abdullah Çatlı. Because if you follow his Wikipedia entries and some of the Turkish press media stuff, you will see then his involvement with all these casinos in Cyprus. These are the Turkish, this is the Turkish portion of Cyprus, the island. You will see his involvement with the First Merchant Bank that we will get into. And so he was one of the mafia also Gladio operatives, but his ranking was, his boss would be Abdullah Çatlı. Abdullah Çatlı's boss would be Mehmet Amor, and this was the high-ranking counterterrorism officer that was, after Susurluk, sent to Turkish embassy in Washington, D.C., to be protected from the investigations of Susurluk there. And he stayed. He was given citizenship 6 months later, not green card citizenship. And this is, it would be equivalent to the counterterrorism czar, if we have such such a thing today in the United States. That was his position. He was the top guy in Turkish government, Turkish intelligence, military intelligence gathering division for Gladio NATO operations. So that would be Abdullah Çatlı's boss, and his boss would be people within the NATO, which would be U.S. arm and especially U.K. arms and some of the CIA actors in there. So if you were to look at the hierarchy, that's how the hierarchy went.
And Yasir Uz, when he was detained, was found to be carrying actually Turkish diplomatic materials, passports or documents of some sort that were signed off on by a Turkish official. Was that the same one that ended up fleeing to Washington?
I believe that was Mehmet R. I know the names, the foreign names are so difficult to follow. And I'm so careful. I'm trying so hard not to throw in too many foreign names. But Mehmet R. was also a major. He was on the police side because we have two types of police in Turkey. One is the gendarma, and then we have the regular lower-level police. And everybody knows that the gendarma one, which is under military intelligence agency, they are the ones who are the first level in harassing people and jailing them, torturing them, or getting them disappear. Which you see that a lot in Turkey, especially during those years. You saw a lot of disappearing people. Journalists would disappear. They would just evaporate. So gendarmes would be carrying out those operations. So that would be Mehmet R. within the same group. This is NATO's Operation Plan A. This was in 1995, 1996. That was switched later. But the importance of this is this. Again, the media, the narrative, the official narrative in the U.S. on the opium production from all the poppies in Afghanistan is that the production stopped because Taliban illegalized it. You know, they were extremist Islamists. And then after 9/11, it started picking up again. And it's not true. That is not true. Opium production was doing quite well in Afghanistan. In fact, if you look at the graph, you would see that it was increasing towards 2000. And then there was this sudden stop in 2000, mid to late 2000, which is extremely important in terms of 9/11. And we'll get to that later, because we know that the United States had very cozy relationship with the Taliban back then. We refer to them as the freedom fighters, the Mujahideen in 1980s. If you go and look at all these documentaries produced by PBS, you see how they were glorified. It didn't matter that they covered up their wives, they were raping little girls or boys. It didn't matter to us that they were extremists, they went to madrasa. It didn't matter to us that they were fanatics. We never talked about those. They were freedom fighters against communists, the bad communists. They were glorified. We loved Mujahideens. We loved the same Talibans that now we portray differently. You know, these monstrous looking, you know, primitive guys, etc. So what happened was then in 1990s, we went back and forth, our relationship with the Talibans. And then there comes this period when we try to actually reestablish our relationship and even recognize Taliban. Remember, this is when Cheney and the group, they brought this Taliban leaders officially to the United States. They even went to Texas. Well, Afghanistan was extremely important to us. I refer to Pipelandistan. This is Pepe Escobar, the way Pepe Escobar puts it, because for all the plans that we had, for the pipelines, for Central Asia, Caucasus, Eurasia, and how things would travel, we needed Afghanistan. And we were coming to the point that we were saying, well, if we have to make a deal and be friends with the Taliban, so be it. We will be. We don't care that they are extremists or fanatics. And During this time, if you go and look at those articles, they're, you know, maybe the links are broken because a lot of links are broken to important articles nowadays. You will see that we were considering to become really good friends with the Taliban. However, back to the heroin production, opium production, what happened is after the Soviet was defeated and they backed off from Afghanistan, the relationship between the Russians and Afghanistan actually didn't end because the military was removed, but you had both the Russian government related, close to Russian government people, the Russian mafia that continued their presence in the region. Why? The opium, heroin. And so during this time, we had basically two groups of players, this time meaning 1990s, in Afghanistan in relation to heroin. A big percentage actually was being operated, transported in the labs processed by the Russian mafia, okay? And then there was a portion that was completely under the control of the Turks, and Turks under Gladio, under NATO Turks, okay? And don't quote me on the percentage, but if I were to throw a percentage, I would say the percentage would be 70% Russians, 30% Turks. And with Russia, again, it, how the route was, the transport of the opium, where the labs were, was completely different category than how the Turks operated. Now, with the Turks, who did we have? We had in the United Kingdom, Baybasin, okay? And they had their networks of network of couriers also, you know, from Afghanistan to get things through the porous borders. And in some cases, a lot of these couriers were the Kurds that were being used, you know. But then once this stuff got into Turkey, and in early 1990s, a lot of labs were placed in Turkey. You know, you need tons of chemicals to turn these poppies into heroin, okay? In Afghanistan, there are primitive ways of going about it. You won't be able to produce tons and tons of heroin that way. You can produce a small quantity, but then there's a sophisticated method, and Turkish labs had this sophisticated methods. In mid-1990s, around 1996, 1997, a lot of these labs actually moved to Central Asia, some of the countries in the Caucasus, because by then, United States, Turks, they had already converted some of these countries. And we refer to Azerbaijan, for example, how Aliyev was more siding with the Russians, with all the assassination attempts, the blackmail through the casinos. We had switched. A lot of labs also moved to Azerbaijan because logistically it was more important. Once it gets to that point, Azerbaijan, Turkey, then the transports, we are not talking about the mules, you know. You know, looking at, you know, Afghanistan, you have to have the couriers in some primitive ways. This is before 9/11, okay, to carry these loads because not through the airplanes there. But then after that, once it gets to Turkey, at this level, you have the heroin. And in, again, in the reports, you see these trucks that are going to Bulgaria from Turkey because Bulgaria's neighbor, Romania, and from there getting into Netherlands and Italy and some of it coming to the United States. But what you don't see is the amount, which is a significant amount, that comes via official channels. And you say that today, and they would call you a conspiracy theorist. They would call you crazy. If I were to tell you that huge amount of this heroin was coming to the United States through Andrews Air Force Base, people would say that is the craziest thing I've ever heard, okay? Because people want to believe that that would be crazy. I mean, there are people, even with all the documents being public, being known, they consider Iran-Contra something that really didn't happen, and it was a conspiracy theory, believe me or not, because it's more convenient to think that way. Because once people understand and believe and see these realities, it will be a something to digest, because that's going to change their viewing of the world and their nation and nationalism. I have a degree in criminal psychology, and my field of study was serial killers. And all these cases, looking at the mothers, even with all the evidence presented, they would say, my son would never do something like that, you know. And in this case, with seeing our government being involved with things like Iran-Contra, you know, with what Gary Webb exposed, I mean, you're looking at crack epidemics. Then you throw in, and even if you were to come and show the documents where FBI is tipped off or DEA about certain military people coming through Andrews Air Force Base, you know, they're coming from either Netherlands or from Brussels, and they land in Andrews Air Force Base, and knowing that this plane is also loaded with heroin, but they can't do anything about it. I mean, who are they going to go after? The FBI. First of all, they have to be given the okay by the FBI's boss. And this plane is loaded only by Americans and the diplomatic community, the military, NATO community. So even if you were to put all these documents and if you would make it public, people would look at you with the blank eyes and they would say, no, that's not possible. Or maybe our government has a very good explanation for this. There must be an explanation for this.
Well, they always have one, don't they? Well, perhaps right. We should back up for a little, because I think it's important to note that the very heroin trade from the opium trade turning into the heroin trade from Afghanistan also originated in NATO operations, or at least in U.S. operations, specifically when we look back at the origins of the Afghan uprising against the Soviets in 1979, really, with Operation Cyclone, as Zbigniew Brzezinski has come out and admitted now that the U.S. was involved even before the Soviets ever came in. And right from the beginning, they were supporting people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, indirectly through Pakistan, but still supporting people like that, which was the basis for this. And of course, this all comes out through the reporting of Alfred McCoy, but perhaps you can talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And I consider him to be the top researcher. And if you were to go and study and read his academic work, all based on research, he's not a conspiracy theorist. He's a professor. He's a very well-respected professor. He's talking about all the parallels, you know, Golden Triangle, Golden Crescent. And he also shows, I mean, how the amount decreases once we leave Vietnam, you know, what was being produced once upon a time in Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, and then the amount increases in Afghanistan. And he provides incredible statistics, graph, showing the correlation between our military, NATO, or our military, CIA being active in places, the drug production, you know, quadrupling, going really up, exploding basically, and then we leave and go somewhere else, and that's where we'll see the same thing starting. So you're absolutely right, because as always, whether through military operations, black ops, we have been relying on narcotics to fund a lot of our operations. Forget about the illegal aspects of heroin. When you look at the world resources and the competition over the world resources, I mean, you think of, okay, there's oil, you know, there is gas, you know, there are the minerals, and people are like, okay, the uranium's here and gold, and, you know, we're looking at diamonds, and, well, they look at the value, market value of heroin. And again, some people, they say currently it's $35 billion worth. Some people are saying, no, it's close to $100 billion of street value. We don't have the value, concrete one established, but when you are looking at something like $50 billion a year, that becomes a very important world resources that people compete over, okay? And this is why I was going to get to the point with the Russians, because after Russians left, well, Russian mafias also wanted a big chunk of it, and actually they got it. And they established their relationship with Taliban, and it was pure business relationship. So they controlled a lot of market. Now, when you fast forward and you come to 9/11, post-9/11, you see that slowly that percentage, actually not very slowly, pretty rapidly went down, Russians' percentage value, the share, and U.S. share went up to a point that today, basically, except for some psychic, Russians don't have any of these resources. So for me, it's very interesting. Russia has been lately been very outspoken and loud, saying They have several million heroin addicts in Russia because of the increase in production in Afghanistan, and this is due to NATO and US. And some of the MPs in Russia, and including generals, top generals, have gone even further. If you go and look at some of these publications, they state that they believe NATO, the CIA, they play the major role, top role, in both production and transportation of this heroin. It's they're saying it's being dumped in our country. We have millions of heroin addicts. And a few months ago, you remember, you and I have been communicating on this, Russians said, we want to participate in this eradication program, which, what a joke. We are, that's what we are doing, Americans there. So U.S. said, okay, fine, we let you be part of this. And then that deal fell through. It didn't go through. Then they went back screaming again about this. Well, part of it is true because the percentage of heroin users in Russia has, I mean, exploded. It's huge, which really brings to mind the opium wars with China. That was a very well planned, you know, strategically planned war. And when you look at all the heroin consumption going up in Russia, it's like the parallel is interesting, but I'm not going to go there. But the other part of Russians being pissed off is that they lost this share because they had the big chunk of this revenue before. They don't now. It is completely, completely handled and controlled from the source, Afghanistan, who has a base there. All the way to the transport through the Balkans. Let me look at, I mean, if you go and look and say Romania, and then you look at Brussels, you look at all these places, and then, of course, some of it comes to the United States. Some people, they say it's only 10% comes to U.S., whatever. So you see that shift. And again, the amount is not just like some peanuts. We are looking at least $50 billion a year worth of resources and how they are being used, what they are doing with it, you know, that's your guess is as good as mine on that. Then again, the other thing that is important, and again, this is post 9/11, and I send you a couple of links. One would be you come across some incidents that are completely buried within the United States media, no reporting. A few years ago, the Dutch police arrested because they were wiretapping this high-level NATO general who was in charge of the NATO base in Romania. And this is Willem Metzer. And this case related to this cocaine that was going to come through couriers and to Italy. And he was basically involved in this cocaine deal and money laundering deal. And this was worth whatever, $20 million, $15 million. Well, he got arrested. Again, he's not your you know, the homie guy out there selling, you know, 3 grams of marijuana, you're looking at several large kilograms of cocaine, and you're looking at a NATO general, active, Romania, okay, base. So he gets arrested, he gets busted by the Dutch police, and then some Kafkaesque court process takes place, and then he's released a few months later, 6 or 7 months later. And then nobody again reports on him of what happened. So you get to have like Bibeson, you get to have Willem Metzer with these NATO actor. Now, what happened here? Why did Dutch police started chasing this guy? Why did they chase this guy? We don't know because there is really not much reportage. Some in UK, some in, you know, Germany, and a couple of reporters in Holland, they wrote about this. But then everybody says, well, the court process was pretty Kafkaesque with all the high-level NATO people coming, being present. And then 6 months later, the judge let him go. Well, this is very, very important. When you start talking about NATO generals being involved in narcotics and money laundering and not being reported, not even one publication here.
Exactly right. And just to be clear for people out there, he was actually arrested on charges of laundering at least $200 million for an international drug cartel that involved people like Mohamed Khaddam and also Pietro Fedino, who's a wealthy Sicilian with a previous conviction for cocaine smuggling. So this is not a small charge by any means. And Willem Metzer, again, part of the NATO staff there, just an incredible connection. But exactly on that point. It raises the question, for example, I can understand how some officials who don't know about the Gladio B operation might accidentally arrest one of these people who are involved with this, which may have been the case with someone like Matzer, for example, because after his show trial, he was released with time served. Yasher Oz manages to escape and is never brought in for questioning ever again.
Exactly.
And yet you have people like Bibeson, who gets thrown in jail and is still there to this day and is likely to rot in jail. So I'm wondering what the discrepancy is there. Is it just a question of some people want to play ball and other people are going to blow the whistle?
That's a very good point. And you're right. Some people always stay within the system. Some people, they get inflicted by this thing called hubris and say, you know what, Michael, I'm getting pretty powerful. Maybe a lot of this, you know, big share cut of it goes to the Turkish government and NATO. I want to maybe have a bigger, they start viewing themselves bigger than what actually they are. And that happens sometimes. And sometimes it happens with the head of the states. You know, it can happen with somebody like Gaddafi. It can happen with Saddam, you know. Say, after a while, it gets to you. It's like, I'm powerful. You know what? I'm going to stand up to these guys too. And the other part of it has to do with the ethnic origin of Bibeson, and that being he, you know, he's Kurdish. And the conflict with the Kurds, because as we talked about before, Kurds are always being used. They're being used, or they were being used by the Israelis. They were used by the U.S. during the no-fly zone. And this is in 1990s with Saddam. They actually are used with the state that's been fighting against them. And that is Turks for a drug operation. Because it's really interesting. On one hand, that faction of Kurds, not all Kurds, serve the Turkish interests. But then those same Kurds would want to have the money associated for providing these services, and then they take that money, then they go and get their own Kalashnikov from the Russians to arm themselves against the Turks. It is so convoluted. And so these relationships and alliances are there. So I believe Bibeson, and again, this is a hypothesis, I don't know the real facts, what happened. I don't even know why they backed off, because some deal was cut through. One of the things that Bibeson was afraid, and I'm going back to my meeting in London at that time, was the Turkish government wanted to see him extradited to Turkey, saying he's a Turkish citizen. Holland, you shouldn't keep him in jail. We want him here. And boy, he didn't want to go to Turkey. Yeah, you know, just lots of quick, mysterious deaths happened there. So this was during this crucial times that not only he was fighting the charges against him and he was appealing, but he was also fighting this attempt by Turkey to extradite him back to Turkey. So this was a time he was saying, well, maybe if I scratch her back, she'll scratch my back, we'll do some stuff. But then some deal took place, and I don't know the details because nobody in the media is reporting. So he stayed in the same jail in Holland, and he actually was taken from high security to the more average prison cell where he can pursue his art interests, etc., etc. And then the communication ceased after that. So maybe during that period, maybe that was why they wanted to contact me, because they were like, maybe this is the card we play, where our case intersects with Sibel Edmund's case if this extradition goes through, to prove that Turkey is in this position, that if I were to be extradited there, this will happen to me. Maybe that would be the time for me to show some of those insurance documents, those insurance that I had on my side. But whatever it was, I guess it was settled and the extradition didn't take place. So the scratching didn't take place. So we didn't scratch each other's back.
Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope the show has helped you to win the war on terror, that is, to refuse to be afraid.